Well, Dennis Lehane, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks for having me.
These stories in Coronado, this is a collection of short stories and a play, the play being the title story. These are very dark.
Which is such a surprise for people who read my normal stuff.
I don't think
Yeah, I mean, they are. Some of them are pretty dark. Certainly, I think this short story, Until Gwen, maybe have the darkest ending of anything I've ever written.
Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, I actually was surprised. I started to write that story as a comedy, which wow. if you see the opening line and then the first really opening scene, that's pretty it's in a pretty comic vein, but then the story just kept getting darker and darker on me. I didn't plan it. It just sort of happened organically.
Well, why? Why do you think that happened?
I don't know. I think I was writing the story under extreme pressure on a deadline, and I don't think I was at a particularly good place in my life at that point, and I wrote it in the middle of a thunderstorm. And so just all these things pushed to make the story become this, I think pretty devastating ending if you look at it in terms of sort of love and loss.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we're talking about the story Until Gwen, is that right?
Yes.
Right. We're actually going to spend some real time on that story, but I'm going to ask you about another story first, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The first story in the book, it's called Running Out of Dog. It's told from the point of view of a Vietnam vet, but he's telling the story about a very deeply disturbed friend of his, Blue, who was not in the Vietnam War, at least as far as I can tell, but who clearly has been in some very horrific wars of his own. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I want to make one other small distinction about Running Out of Dog that often gets lost is the actual narrator is the town.
The actual narrator is the town.
Is the town. If you look at the opening and the end, the beginning and the ending, the frame of the story, the person who leads you in is a collective we.
That's true, and yet it's really the character of Elgin that...
Then we go into Elgin's point of view, which is, I would say, maybe a little bit untrustworthy. And then we come back out in the town's point of view. So it's just a very tricky story in terms of point of view. And I think that I've been waiting years for people to truly get what the ending of that story, and nobody does. And then I was speaking to a bunch of hardcore juveniles in Orlando who had read the book, and these are all kids who are doing at least 20 years or more in a juvenile prison and then going to cycle into adult prison. And this one kid stood up and he asked me a question, the question I've been waiting 9 years to hear. And he got it. He said, "I don't think you can trust who's telling this story." And I said, "Oh, my God." So, yeah, it's very much a story about this guy, Blue, who's never... I was kind of questioning the idea of, A, people who suddenly snap. People who, the kind of guy who goes postal, what creates that, what's the moment? And then I was also questioning this idea of people who it seems to me are kind of hurled into the world with no tools to adapt to it. And that's the vast majority of people, you know?
Well, but he more than most, I mean, we never hear about his childhood, but he must have been horribly abused. And you write that a small town is a hard place to keep a secret. I think that is... That is in the voice of the town in the very first paragraphs. Everybody knows he's going to snap, but nobody feels that they can do anything about it.
Which I think, unfortunately, is really, is normally the case. I mean, we always see after all of these, after all of these situations with, Virginia Tech, we know he was disturbed. What can you do?
But Elgin does do something about it. So why are you saying that we can't trust him? That we can't trust his point of view?
I'm just not sure you can at the end. I think you need to, look. There's certain clues in there that maybe you can't, and maybe what Elgin did was a little less community-oriented than he'd like to have us believe. So it's a cold-blooded execution, there's some question as to what his motives really were in the end.
Well, you had me. You had me believing him.
And you know what? And that's wonderful. I think it's absolutely wonderful. If I can have a story that can work on two different interpretations, I'm ecstatic. because the editor of that story was the first person I remember saying something to him where I just said, nobody ever gets it, it's an unreliable narrator. And he looked at me and he said, and this is the guy who had edited the story, and said, there's an unreliable narrator? So I'm fine with that. I'm totally fine with that. But that's a story that the first version of that I ever wrote, which is very, very different, was something I wrote back in graduate school. That's how old that story is, certainly the idea for it.
Now, there's a real marvelous deftness with the dialogue throughout all these stories, certainly in that one. The language of the people comes through so strongly. Did you grow up in a small town like this?
No. I grew up in the inner city of Boston, but I went to school down south. And I always say that if you become a writer, you have to be born with at least one gift in the in the writer's arsenal, at least one, and you're going to learn the rest. And then some people, Martin Amis, John Updike, they were probably born with four.
And what are some of those gifts?
Say an ear for dialogue, an ability to say paint the landscape, a sense, a depth of insight. Just what we think of when we think of the hallmarks of literature. Not every writer has everything when they come through the gate. What I had was an ear, and the ear was always just sort of tuned to the way anybody talks. It wasn't just the Boston vernacular. It was whenever I would go anywhere, I would immediately start picking up on the speech patterns of the people around me.
And did you write that down as you would hear it? I mean, are you one of those writers who will carry around the notebook?
When I was a kid, I would. When I was a kid, I would write down exactly what I heard. Now it's just second nature. So by the time I moved down to the South when I was 20, I just started immediately picking up, the cadence of the place. And then that's what I tried to do with Running Out of Dog and Gone Down to Corpus. Certainly two very Southern stories to me, and I tried to capture the cadence of the place.
Now, cadence is something that people do share regionally, but people are also very individual. So once you have that kind of cadence, how do you kind of tease out the differences in how the individual characters will talk?
Well, I think that speaks to process, and I'm not sure that I'm very good at articulating that. That's the wonderful thing that I think gets lost in a literal age is there is a mystery to the arts. There is a mystery to the creative process. And it's those are the reasons we do it. I mean, those are the most pleasurable things. Where did that line come from? I don't know.
The art and the craft, in other words, that there's a difference between the two.
Yeah, there are, yes, for the most part, it's a craft, but then there are these sort of mystical aspects for it. Now, if you fall in love with the mystical aspects of it, then you're going to probably end up being a very bad writer. But you can't deny sometimes. When people say, where do you get your ideas? Mm-hmm. I've watched writers give answer after answer, and the truth, if you really put a gun to our head, is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no clue. I sit in a room, I stare at a ceiling, and suddenly something appears out of the ether. I have no idea how it happens.
Or a thunderstorm.
Or a thunderstorm, exactly. Exactly. And so that's a wonderful part of the process I never want to lose. And so my ability to sort of climb in and distinguish between voices or climb into characters and suddenly just be channeling their voice is not something I necessarily want to know how I know how to do.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with short story writer and novelist and playwright Dennis Lehane about his most recent book of short stories and a play, Coronado. Now, it seems to me also that these stories really center around, they really say a whole lot about class, and particularly about the working class.
Yeah.
There are some authors like Richard Russo who also treat this, but it's rarer in American fiction these days than it used to be. And I felt also there was what I call, or what a book from a long time ago that I read calls, the hidden injuries of class. Does that phrase make any sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, I think the people who are working, sort of writing about class are doing it really at an exceptional level would be, Rick Russo, Richard Price, George Felicano in Washington, D.C., Russell Banks, So it is being done. Raymond Carver did it as good as anybody has ever done it. But, yeah, I mean, I think that I'm somebody who has now reached a level of success far beyond anything I ever expected to reach. And yet I still am just sort of one extremely thin layer of skin from Glacier Edge.
What do you mean?
It's very easy to get my back up in terms of class issues that I feel even today, even to this day. I feel as if people are assuming I am a lesser individual or assuming I am a less intelligent individual because of how I speak or where I come from or how I look. It's funny. There's a wonderful New England author named Roland Marullo. I don't know if you know his work at all.
Could you say his name again?
Roland Marullo.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote like Revere Beach Boulevard. He and I have talked about it. He grew up, you know, Italian and revered, like 15 years before I grew up Irish in Dorchester, and it's an incredible mutual understanding and meeting of the minds between people when you talk about what it was like to grow up in sort of those neighborhoods and then step into Brahmin Boston and to be treated as, and then this is nothing compared to the way, say, a black person or a Puerto Rican would have been treated, you know?
And yet a whole lot more people may be aware of how a black person or a Puerto Rican person are treated because it is much more talked about. I mean, yes, you have talked about a number of writers, but in the general culture, don't you feel that it's much more hidden?
Yeah, because nobody wants to. We want to pretend we're a classless society, and we are by no means a classless society.
So what is the impact? I mean, could you imagine writing about anybody else then?
Oh, sure. I mean, I can. Absolutely. I mean, in my new, the novel I just completed, which took 4 years, the central characters, the two central characters are, sort of an Irish police officer from a much more politically connected family, almost like a Kennedy type of family, and then a black machinist from Ohio. And I can definitely swim in, I don't always have to be working about the, writing about the completely marginalized in society. But at the same time, I don't think I could ever comfortably write about a blue blood. It would come off as kind of cliched, I think, because I don't understand them. I don't know what's in their kitchens.
And even a policeman and a machinist, I mean, they may be the elite of the working class, but they're still the working class.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's where I'm most, at the end of the day, that is where I am most comfortable. And when you're doing something, I think you get to an age in any creative process where you say, well, I could reinvent the wheel as I wanted to do when I was 28 or 29, but why really go to the trouble? I mean, this is what I do well. So why attempt to do something that I probably don't do well at all? I mean, Fitzgerald got the rich down pretty well. What am I going to add?
And these are wonderful, wonderful stories. In fact, I think my personal favorite was Until Gwen. And the word that comes to mind, and I think also you felt that way too, Michael, is that
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes, definitely.
The word that came to mind, we were talking about it, Michael and I, yesterday, and I said, what is this genre? And Michael said, it's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually a genre we actually think of in terms of drama. So, maybe it's not a surprise that you did turn it into a play. But before we get to the play, tell us what this story is about, and do you feel it is a tragedy?
Yeah, I think that I've taught classes on roman noir, and argued that noir is working class tragedy. That's exactly what it is. So it's sort of like epic tragedy played out on a much smaller scale among lives that are not, say, the Aristotelian lives, the lives of great kings and great men falling from high mountains. So when you write, down and dirty noir, you are writing about people falling from a much lower ledge, but they're still falling just as hard. And that's something that with Until Gwen, I did not set out. The only thing I had when I wrote Until Gwen at 7 o'clock in the evening when I started it was that first sentence, which I've been carrying around for about 7 years.
Maybe we should say what that first sentence is.
I hope I could quote it. It's your father picks you up from prison in a stolen Dodge Neon with an 8-ball of coke in the glove compartment and a hooker named Mandy in the back seat. And I'd had that line since I was a graduate student in Miami, and I wrote it down and just put it in my wallet. And then I had to write this story. I'd agreed to write this story and then forgot about it, and then I was way past deadline. And the editor called me up, and he was a friend of mine, and he said, I need the story. And I said, when? And he said, 2 weeks ago. And so I went out on my porch, and I sat down, and I had that first line. And I wrote the first line, and then I wrote the next line, and I wrote the next line, and I wrote the next line. Then the storm came in, and I have this wraparound porch that's surrounded by 100-year-old wisteria, so the water couldn't hit me. But the storm was right outside, you know, was literally an inch away from me. And it was just a wonderful way to write. It was a beautiful September night, you know, and writing in the rain. And I wrote from 8 o'clock in the evening until about 3 o'clock in the morning. And that was the first draft. And I had no idea. I had no idea what they were looking for. I had no idea who Gwen was. I remember getting to around page 12 and saying, I should probably figure out what this is that they're looking for here. Which is, again, it's a fun thing to teach your students. I mean, David Mamet has a wonderful line about drama where he says, if the character wants anything, so much as a loaf of bread, the audience will follow. So you don't even have to know what your characters want. You just have to have them want something. So I had these two guys driving around West Virginia looking for something, and even I didn't know what it was. And then just as the story progressed, I just really, you know, realized I was writing a story about almost indescribable loss. And then a sort of Oedipal, definitely an Oedipal thing going on between, you know, with the father. And it just completely happens organically. I look back and I just say the only thing I can see in that story that I must have been channeling was, I think I was reading a little bit too much Cormac McCarthy at that point. I think, you know, I can feel him in the final scene. No, and I don't mean that in a good way. I mean that in a sort of oof, you know. Channeled a little less of him. But, yeah, and then that story, which, again, I just wrote in one night, and then I got up the next morning and realized the only thing I'd screwed up on was the point of view. And I just said this should be in second person. And I rewrote the entire rewrote the story in second person, and then I just mailed it off, and that was it. And I forgot about it, and it became this, you know, anything I've ever written, it became sort of, it had the longest kind of surprising life of its own. It continued to metamorphosize. It's just every time I thought it was down, it came back up. Became a play. It became a screenplay. It became, won a bunch of awards. It had a very strange life, that story.
We are speaking with Dennis Lehane, author of Coronado, his most recent collection of short stories and a play by that same title. Also best-selling author of Mystic River, if you're wondering where you've heard that name before. So, Dennis, you turned Until Gwen into a play.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about why you did that?
And also tell our listeners a little bit about the story, as much as you'd like, just to kind of orient them to it.
Well, Until Gwen is a story about a young man who's just gotten out of prison and his father, who is a sociopath, and they are driving around a small, in the play, it's an unnamed town in this short story, I believe it's in West Virginia. They're driving around a small town, and they are looking for a diamond. And what is gradually revealed is that the son probably knows where it is, and the father desperately wants it, to the point where he may kill the son, he may have killed other people already to get to this thing.
The diamond.
The diamond. And that's pretty much the story, and it's one of the stories in the play. There are three stories in the play, one of whom is Bobby and Bobby's father from Until Gwen. And, that's pretty much the story. And the play came about because my brother, who is an actor, I have always wanted to write a part for him. He has always wanted me to write a part for him, but we could just never make it come together. And then we were hanging out at my house one Christmas, and I said, well, you know, I got a story I might be able to turn into a play. And that's how we came up with the idea, and I wrote the part of Bobby's father for my brother.
Then you weave in two other stories, as you've just said, And you really do weave them in. They almost become a single story at the end. They all
well,
meet.
That's the yeah. That was the point. I was starting to write. I wrote the story. I started to write the play, and I had these two other stories in there. And at first, I thought what I was doing was riffing on noir. So you look at the your basic setups, and they're pretty classic noir setups. You know, the young lovers who must kill her husband, the psychiatrist with the patient who has the goods on him, if you will, and is about to bend him to her will. And I couldn't figure out what these people were doing and who they were and how they connected to Bobby and Bobby's father. And then as I progressed in the writing of it, all of a sudden I had my voila moment, my epiphany. And I went, oh, wait a minute, now I understand how these people are connected, and that's the whole point of the play.
And also, the play itself seems to explain some of the reasons for the relationships, but for instance, between Bobby and Bobby's father and the mother. Mm-hmm. And the other characters come in, and there was a sense of the, more was revealed in the play. And I wonder if that's something you wanted to bring to something more to light than you had in the story.
Yeah, it was an opportunity to do just that. Again, I think the best stuff that I tend to do is stuff that's the least schematic and the least, you know, I don't want to plan something to the death of itself, because I found that when I do that, the results aren't very good.
What do you mean by that in the context of this story?
Well, in the context of this story, if I knew that I was sitting down and I was going to be writing a story that was basically a play that, you know, could have been subtitled "The Evolution of a Psychopath," I don't think I would have done a very good job of it. I just began to go in and notice that what was bubbling up was a lot of questions about, you know, about the possibility or the impossibility of love, and that becomes what the main argument is between Bobby and his father: is love possible in this world?
So they're really on two very different levels. I mean, in some ways, the fact that so much is hidden and unexpressed in the story constitutes some of its power. And yet you do want to get the explanation, and you're happy to be able to read it in the play.
Right. And then even in the play, though, I think there's a sort of, I mean, maybe my favorite moment in the play, I thought, which again surprised me, I didn't mean to do it, is when he finally explains about meeting this woman. The father has the conversation where you realize he was actually once in love, and he says, you know, she wore a blue dress, and I felt as if God had given birth to me that day. And the son says, "That's it." And the father says, "You can't explain love, mm-hmm. what it does, how it hits you. You end up sounding like an idiot." And I was after that idea of the sort of inability, the ineffability of love itself. So it was, again, it was a completely organic process. It was so much fun. I did half of that play. The second half of that play was written while I was workshopping the first half with a bunch of actors. So it came out of a very organic process of, you know, in a performance space above a Chinese restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. In the heat of, you know, in the heart of a summer, it was just a great, great experience. And I, that's the other thing I do tell my students a lot is, you know, anybody who's into writing, if you're not doing it for the pure pleasure of it, if you're not doing it for some part of you loses that, hey, my dad's got a barn, let's put on a show aspect, then go sell stocks.
So keep the mystery alive.
Keep the part of you that's a kid alive.
Yeah.
You know, at some level, I think any writer would back me up, I would think, on that that idea that there has to be a child in you to be creative.
And when it's going well, I've often said it's better than sex. But when it's not going well, there's nothing quite
worse
like
than death.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, it's yeah. A good day of writing is the best day of your life, and a bad day of writing is the worst day of your life.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, a poet, has a great line. She says, "When it works, you have this moment where you look at it, and it's the purest feeling in the world. Is this exists only because I do?"
Wow.
Now, you know, this spontaneity you're talking about, or this wonderful lack of control, is wonderful when it's working well as a writer. Your characters, however, don't have control, and it's awful. You know.
Well, thank you.
So,
thank you.
Do you have a sense of life in general as being something that we have no control over, and sometimes that's good, and in your stories, it's awful.
It can be. I mean, I think that we live with the... We spend a lot of time building up this illusion of control. Mm-hmm. And in some places, we do what we can to control some aspects of our life. But, yeah, at the end of the day, it's the postponable truth. It's the thing we want to block out, which is... No, we're pretty much free falling. Mm. Yeah, and some of us are going to land quite fine, and others aren't.
And it seems that that's something that folks who are from the working class are much more aware of, perhaps, than the kind of the illusion of those in the middle class or upper middle class who think that the world is their oyster.
Yeah, yeah. I have my best friend and I, we have this sort of secret understanding between each other, because we're extremely optimistic in our day-to-day lives. We tend to be very much can-do people. But we've had this conversation about how we are optimists because we are secretly pessimists, because we have seen what the world can do.
How does that work?
You just say, okay, you can either be cowed by it, or you can say, look, it's going to get me one way or the other. So I might as well enjoy myself in between those poles of potential tragedy.
Kind of like being in a war in a way. I mean, I've heard about people being in war sometimes, just not caring anymore. It's just, well, if this is my day to die, is my day to die.
Right, but it's also saying, look, this is my day to live.
Right.
This, I got this day.
It's kind of freedom.
You know? It's a freedom that you can just say, look, what a wonderful day this is, you know, because I know that tomorrow everything could go south. But man, it's you know, right now where I'm talking to you from, it's 65 and sunny.
Where are you talking to us from?
I'm actually in Florida right now.
Lucky man.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think, again, having grown up, you know, with a father who had to take several jobs during the recessions of the 70s, just to keep his family afloat, and seeing that incredible pressure. I mean, there's just nothing to me more heroic than the working class parent.
Yeah.
Because what they are carrying, the weight of financial strain that they are carrying, would crush most people, myself included. You know, that's why the real heroes of our society are, you know, the teachers and the truck drivers and the, you know, that's the people who are sort of making that income that just puts them right on the cusp, and yet they continue to do it. Some because they have no choice, but some truly choose to do this. Mm. You know, like most social workers choose to be social workers.
I was just going to say, yeah, I was a social worker, so I totally, and I thought when I became a social worker, I thought I was going to finally make it into the, you know, the solid middle class. Little did I know how little they make.
Oh, yeah, they don't make anything. I mean, even with an MSW.
That's right.
You know? But, you know, those are the sort of the silent heroes of our society, in my opinion.
Now, on another topic, you have, there's a movie out of a screenplay of your book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's Gone Baby Gone, and it was, the screenplay was written by Ben Affleck and a man named Aaron Stoppard. And the film's directed by Ben Affleck and stars his brother Casey, and it's a wonderful film. I just can't say enough about it. I'm so pleased with it on every level. And my original sentiment was that I was going to be you would have had a easier time finding Hoffa than finding me when this film came out. because if I don't like a film based on one of my books, I will not be one of those authors who goes out and slags it in public. I just think that is just such bad form. It reminds me of the old joke about the guy walking out of the bordello claiming he didn't feel loved. you took the money, shut up. But what I would not do is step in front of a movie and speak positively about it. I would just vanish. But On Baby Gone, Ben Affleck has made it a terrific film, a really superior crime film.
And it's been doing very well it's gotten the critics behind it.
The critics are behind it. At its center is a real breakthrough performance by a woman named Amy Ryan. And I think everybody fully expects she'll get an Oscar nomination. It's got Ed Harris in it, Morgan Freeman. I mean, it's a really good film. It's just not a feel good film.
Right.
I can't say I'm proud of it because I had nothing to do with it. But I think they have every right to be proud of it.
Well, Dennis Lehane, we look forward to having you come to our area. You're going to be coming to the 22nd Right Angles Conference of the National Writers Union.
I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it. I did the second signing of my life at the Odyssey Bookstore in South Hadley. So that is a very special place.
You're kidding. When was that?
You want the exact date?
No.
Exact date.
It was
November 11th, 1994.
Wow, that's terrific. That's great. So, my favorite bookstore.
Oh, is it? It's just so wonderful. And they took a chance on a complete nobody and let me sign there. I think six people showed up. And five of them worked for the bookstore. But that's a really special place to me. So anything connected to that region, I'm always happy to be involved.
Oh, that's great. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. And we loved this wonderful book, Book of Short Stories, Coronado by Dennis Lehane.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And drive safely.
I will.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Julia Glass, welcome to Writer's Voice. The whole world over, this is your second novel.
Yes.
The first being Three Junes.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about the themes of this novel.
Well, when I started writing The Whole World Over, I thought I was writing a marriage novel, as I called it, or a marriage and fidelity novel. And I wanted to focus on a husband and wife. And I knew that the wife, Greenie Duquette, a pastry chef, was going to be the protagonist, or what I call the alpha protagonist, because I can never resist having several main characters in a piece of fiction. And I thought I would write the novel going back and forth between her point of view and her husband's point of view. In Greenie Duquette, I created a character quite different from any I had created before, in that she's congenitally happy. I realized that all the characters I'd written before, culminating, I suppose, in Fenno MacLeod, who is the protagonist of Three Junes, I always chose characters who were, to put it in a nutshell, neurotic New Yorkers, people who either had been in psychotherapy for 20 years or ought to have been. But I wanted to write about somebody who had achieved almost everything she wanted in life and yet had hit a wall. And that wall was her husband's withdrawal from her and his depression. And the way in which Greenie Duquette sets about to try to jumpstart her marriage leads to a whole domino effect of fateful events, not just in their lives, but in the lives of people around them, their five-year-old son, and then two other main characters who came almost unbidden into this story, Walter Kinderman, who is a gay restaurateur in the West Village and is Greenie Duquette's primary client. He runs a very old-fashioned American restaurant for which she makes the desserts, and he is in search of a soulmate. He's led a fairly happy-go-lucky life, but he's also somewhat old-fashioned, and he's very much a survivor of what gay New Yorkers often call the plague years.
Right.
This novel takes place in 2000 and 2001. I know I'm not answering your question about themes, but I'll just say that the fourth character is a young woman named Saga who's recovering from a head injury that's left her with memory deficits. And what I came to realize through the writing of this book is that I wasn't just writing about marriage and fidelity and true love. I was writing about how those things that when we're young we believe will come easily to us, even though they have not come easily to our parents or to all those square old folks, finding our place in the world, finding a soulmate, making a family, having children, that that for us, as for those who went before us, they will be just as hard, just as difficult, and that in finding lasting love, if we're lucky enough to do that, we'll have to make compromises, we'll have to recognize the limitations of the separations between people who love each other very much, and our inability to find, to always find happiness for the people we love as well as for ourselves. And the original title of the book was actually a piece of cake. And it was the double entendre of the fact that, in a way, everything in this novel takes place because a particular person eats a particular piece of cake, but also in the sense that all those things in life we thought would be a piece of cake are very much not.
Well, exactly. I think that was what was so wonderful and surprising for me in the book. I kept on being surprised because I think it's rare to find a piece of fiction in which the characters are really so nuanced. I mean, there are no villains, there are no heroes. Everybody struggles with their issues. I mean, even people who you would like to root against, let's say, like Walter's, there's somebody that Walter falls in love with who dumps his own lover, and we won't say what happens with Walter, but you kind of, you know, you want to not like him, but you like him. You like them all. Or Governor Ray McRae, who is
the Republican governor of New Mexico, with apologies to Bill Richardson.
Yeah, exactly. The Republican governor, you know, he's a pretty sympathetic character, too. Everyone has their nuance. So I'd like to ask you, from what well does that complexity of character come as you're writing?
Well, you know, the kinds of characters that I'm drawn to the most, and I'm talking about my life as a reader, are the characters who are in many ways quite disagreeable, often intelligent but highly flawed characters. And yet the author does this extraordinary bit of psychological wizardry by first making you hugely empathic with that character so that you can't dismiss the character out of hand. And you may even come to see elements of yourself in that character. And you go through the ordeals that that character must justifiably go through because of his or her weaknesses. And in the end, your heart is broken by that character, or you experience the triumph of that character overcoming folly. I think human folly is one of the greatest subjects of fiction. And it's also something we all need to face. Whether it's folly of going to war or folly of falling in love with the wrong person, the folly of not understanding our children and observing them for who they are. I mean, there's an endless menu.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Julia Glass about her novel, The Whole World Over. It's just been issued in paperback. Now, also in your characters, I think another really striking aspect of reading this is how you capture the different voices. It's an unusual novel, I think, in the sense that you really, you know, you say you have a main protagonist, but other protagonists, and so you really do, you look at the world out of their point of view. Mm-hmm. The point of view changes in that novel. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that process of getting into the characters so that you can take on these different voices.
Well, this novel is told from four points of view, but unlike Three Junes, in no place is it told in the first person. Again, I was making some choices when I started writing this book to differentiate it from Three Junes. I didn't want to fall into some of the habits and the same storylines as Three Junes. So I don't create a voice the way I did for Fenno MacLeod, but I was very attentive to the differences among these four characters. Now, Greeny Duquette...
No, he's not one of the four
Fenno
main
MacLeod characters. But Fenno MacLeod is the protagonist of Three Junes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And he does come back, for those of you who've read Three Junes mm-hmm. and not The Whole World Over, he comes back as a secondary character here. And although you never see the world through his eyes again, his presence does affect the fates of certain characters in this book. I did not expect him to come back when I started The Whole World Over. And when he did, it was a surprise, and I was a little worried about myself, but it ended up working. So going back to the main characters here, it's interesting when you create characters, you as a writer, and especially as a novelist, because you have to know that you can live with these characters for a matter of years, unless you're Joyce Carol Oates, and then it's a matter of weeks, perhaps. But it takes me a few years to write a novel. So you have to know that you want to inhabit that character's soul for that period of time. But you often can't anticipate what the challenges will be as you go forward with that character. Now, with Greeny Duquette, I had created this very confident, successful character, and that was fairly new for me. But what I didn't realize was how, in a way, that would set the reader a little bit against her. It's funny, I also came to realize in writing this book that I think in some ways it's easier to make the reader fall for a character who's a little down on their luck, not mm-hmm. someone who kind of has the world in her hand. So if this character has the world in her hand and then she goes and blows it by making a decision that you could see as smart in one way and as incredibly vain and stupid in another. And likewise, this character Walter Kinderman, who initially I created only as a kind of prop. You know, I thought, well, here's this pastry chef. She has to have a client. Here's this guy with this charming old-fashioned restaurant in the West Village. But then I began to kind of follow him. Now, Walter, who's, you know, in his 40s, gay, very extroverted, charming, became the character that it's hard to admit this. You don't want to say that you like some children better than others. But I loved writing Walter. And whenever I got to one of his chapters, it was as if I could just sink into a big red velvet couch. And I can't really explain why. Because he, too, is going through troubles and making mistakes, falling in love with the wrong people. You know, he also has this illusion that he can become a pseudo-parent and take on this teenage nephew who decides he wants to be a rock star and not go to college. And, of course, that leads to all kinds of trouble for him as well. Yet, I inhabited Walter so easily. And Saga, this character who's had the head injury and is really struggling to find a functional life when she now has an unreliable memory, I had to be very hyper-conscious about creating that character. I didn't want to do too much medical research about brain injury, because then I felt I would write a character who was very clinical. So a lot of her symptoms and her difficulties are wholly invented, though, as we all know from Oliver Sacks, the brain is a peculiar organ and can misfire in many ways. Yet I had to make sure that I stayed true to a character who can't take for granted even her everyday surroundings. For instance, when she cooks in this kitchen, she often can't remember where things are from day to day. And the funny thing is that this character, who in some ways I had to police myself the most closely in creating, is the one that many readers tell me they love the best.
I actually am with you. I think I loved Walter the best. And I want to go back to him for a minute because, you know, he's gay, you're straight. It felt to me that you completely captured what I would imagine is his voice, and it is a very clear, it's the kind of voice that I recognize from my gay male friends, mm-hmm. without it shading over into stereotype. And I just wondered, you know, the dialogue, for example, is so true, the voice is so true, that I guess I'd like to ask you to say a little bit about how do you tease that different kind of dialogue, how do you tease out that kind of different voice in your characters? And I understand, because I went and saw you talk yesterday, that you write dialogue at a different time.
Well, I write dialogue very much at the moment I'm typing into the keyboard. I spoke about how a lot of the decisions I make about my characters' lives, about their nature, I make when I'm just out and about in the world in what I call the in-between time of life, waiting in line at the post office, shopping for groceries, walking to pick my kids up at the playground, whatever it is. But this is what writing dialogue is like for me. When I write dialogue, in the beginning, everybody sounds exactly like me. And dialogue is something that comes alive and becomes individualized only through radical revisions over and over and over again. I am addicted to revision. I think you actually can't be a good writer of any kind if you don't love reading your work over and over and over. In fact, that's the most fun, is when you've already created the stuff. That's the hard part. And it's not that it isn't hard work to revise and get exactly the right word, but that's the that's the work that to me is the most invigorating, is to even read my own work aloud to myself. And it's important to literally hear the voices in your fiction. And that's when I begin to really listen to my characters, not just know them, but listen to them.
We're talking with Julia Glass about her novel, The Whole World Over. So talk about Walter, because he does sound quite different than others.
You know, I lived in New York for 24 years, and, you know, a number of my friends, and close friends, too, were gay men. Now, none of the gay men in my fiction, and in Three Junes, the main character is Fenno McLeod, who's gay. He's an ex-Scottish expatriate bookseller in New York City. But also there's another very important character there, a music critic for the New York Times who's dying of AIDS, who's got a more acerbic sense of humor. There is a kind of gay sense of humor. I hope I'm not stepping off a cliff to say that, but whether it's about culture or it's about social mores or it's about parenting. And I will say that when I had kids in New York and they started to go to preschool, because we lived in the village, some of the parents were gay parents. And I have to tell you that there's nobody who can skewer the preciousness of modern parenting better than two gay men who have chosen to be parents, because they just see it all from the outside. And, you know, they're reading What to Expect When You're Expecting and all these parenting books too, but they see it from a different viewpoint, because for most of them, it's not something they ever thought they'd get to do. You know, I remember complimenting one dad on the gorgeous little dresses that his daughter had. His daughter was my son's best friend in preschool. And I said, "Where do you get her dresses?" And he looked at me, he said, "Oh, I don't buy her dresses. Her nanny buys her dresses. I wouldn't know the first thing about buying dresses." And of course, I felt embarrassed that maybe I'd been, you know, had he thought that I thought he secretly liked to go about in drag? When every time I met him, he was in a suit and tie like any other dad, dropping his daughter off at preschool before going to work. So that sense of humor is just, it's something I've lived with for many, many years. I don't even really have to think about it. I mean, sometimes it feels like it's politically incorrect to acknowledge it. Well, we're all people. You know, what makes us different? And by the same token, when people seem amazed that I can write from a gay point of view, I say it's much more challenging for me to write from an older person's point of view or even a child's point of view than it is to write from the point of view of somebody my age with my degree of education, whether gay or straight.
You know, and you mentioned child. Another really striking character in this book is George, who, after all, is only 5 years old, mm-hmm. a preternaturally mature 5 years old in some ways. I wanted to ask you about an incident in the book involving him. Without giving too much away, he and his mother go out to New Mexico to work for this governor.
Yes.
And he gets, he makes a very good friend and an older boy, and they get into some really serious trouble at a certain point. I wondered, how did that come about, that he got into that kind of trouble? Maybe you could describe first what George is like, and then why you wrote that into the book.
Well, first of all, I probably owe a certain degree of apology to my older son, who he's now 11, but at the time that I was writing this book, he was George's age. And like George, or George, like my son Alec, becomes a reader very early on. And I stole much of the dialogue and the kind of dialogue that Greeny Duquette has with her son George from conversations that I had with Alec. So I have to say, I probably did more direct pilfering from my son Alec than I did from any other person in my life in creating a character. But my son has not gotten into the kind of trouble that George gets into in this book. You know, without saying that Greeny was a negligent parent, or even Alan, whom we haven't really spoken about, who's a very important character, George's father, who's a psychotherapist, I do think that sometimes when you have a very precocious child, you assume that they're able to take better care of themselves, and by that I mean psychologically, than they really are. They appear to be far more independent, far more self-sufficient, and more mature, in fact, than they really are. And that's what happens. Greeny becomes very caught up in her life. And she meets a man from much earlier in her life when she's in New Mexico. I don't think we said this, but the enormous decision that she makes at the beginning of the book is to accept the chance to be the private chef for this fictitious governor of New Mexico. And she believes that this will jumpstart her marriage. And if she can move her husband away from New York, his depression will somehow break open. Of course, as we all know, just changing locations does not solve our problems. It simply packs them up and moves them with us.
And she does this without really consulting him.
Well, she does, but she presents it to him as in a way as a fait accompli. It becomes very clear that she's the alpha spouse, shall we say, and she makes a fairly unilateral decision. And Alan is very caught up in his depression, so you know one must acknowledge that he doesn't put up much of a fight. He's in a dark night of the soul, and he has a secret that the reader will find out before she does, and that is very much part of the source of his withdrawal from her and from everyone. But George is this, I mean, I wanted to create him as this luminous little being who revolves kind of like a moon around his parents, but also obviously changes the dynamic of their marriage, also changes what's at risk for them. I wanted to write about how having children changes the entire landscape of marriage and changes where you set the bar. Now, obviously, as I said earlier, the fate of this marriage between Greeny and Alan is in a way the backbone of this, or the evolution of this marriage over this 2-year period of time. And in the middle of the book, the reader has no idea, I imagine, whether they will stay together or split apart. And in fact, I changed my mind a couple of times through the course of writing the novel over 4 years as to whether they should or would stay together.
I wondered about that because I kept on thinking, oh, well, they'll never stay together. Oh, well, you know, they're going to stay together. Well, no, they won't stay.
Right.
So I went through the same thing.
But what happens to George and how they see George is very much a part of what happens to them in the end. And, you know, I think part of this comes of my being at a stage in life where, you know, I'm 51 years old, and over the last 10 years, I've seen a number of people that I believed would stay together forever split apart, or people that I believed would split apart find a way to stay together. And it's interesting to see the different choices that people make related not just to their being spouses or mates, but to their being parents.
We're talking with Julia Glass about her second novel, The Whole World Over. She's the author of Three Junes. So we haven't really talked much about the role that food plays in this book. And it does play a very central role. In fact, there are mouth-watering... I wondered if you scoured the menus of upscale New York restaurants for writing this book.
Well, first of all, I didn't have the budget to scour the up.
Or did you consult the cookbooks?
You know, I write about food a lot, and people say, oh, you must love to cook. Well, the truth is, I really love to eat, and I love to feed people. I think there's no more wonderful gathering than a fabulous dinner party that you can throw at your own home. I mean, sometimes conversation rises to just a really soulful pitch. So in Three Junes, Fenno McLeod, who's the hero of that novel, has a brother who's a chef. And food definitely plays a role in Three Junes. But I thought to myself, you know, I only flirted with my love of food in that book, and I am just going to ravish it now. And my joke to all my friends was that if I wrote about a pastry chef, it meant that I could, whenever I went out to dinner, I could order dessert and call it research for however long it took me to write this book. So there's a lot about desserts and a lot about food. But when I create food in fiction, I create it the same way that I do character. I just throw in a pinch of this and a pinch of that in my head. So I have no idea whether in real life these ingredients would really marry all that well. It's my creation. And for instance, I created the signature coconut cake for Greeny Duquette. And I was very touched when I did a book event recently where it was at a literary festival in Newburyport, Massachusetts. They decided to have a pastry chef at a very nice restaurant make three of the desserts. Now, there being no actual recipes, she just created them from the descriptions. She created these tiny white chocolate eclairs that Greeny makes, and she made this rich, incredible chocolate cake. And this coconut cake, which I describe as having a filling of lemon curd and a brown sugar glaze. Now, I've never had that cake. I would love to eat that cake. So lo and behold, this pastry chef made that cake. And she told me she made the lemon curd, she made the coconut cake, and then she thought about the brown sugar, and she decided that what she would do is spread brown sugar on the surface of the cake and burn it with a blowtorch, the way that modern chefs do creme brulee. And so I actually got to eat it.
And what was it like?
Well, first of all, it was overwhelmingly sinfully sweet. It's the kind of dessert that can almost set your teeth on edge, but it was heaven. It really was heaven.
That's wonderful. Now, could you read a little section from the book? I've asked you to pick something out for us, and since we've been talking about food, you've chosen a section related to that.
Right. I'm actually going to be reading about the character Walter Kinderman, who is the best friend and main client of the novel's protagonist, and this is quite early on in the novel. Walter was the owner and gadabout host of a popular local restaurant. Certainly not the chef. He couldn't have washed a head of lettuce to save his life. It was a retro American tavern that served high cholesterol, high on the food chain meals, with patriarchal hubris. Aptly, if immodestly named, Walter's place felt like a living room turned pub. On the ground floor of a brownstone, down the street from Greeny's apartment, it featured two fireplaces, blue checked tablecloths, a fashionably weary velvet sofa, and, bored of health be damned, a roving bulldog named the Bruce. As in Robert the Bruce, Greeny had wondered but never asked. More likely, the dog was named after some fetching young porn star, object of Walter's cheerfully futile longing. He'd never been too explicit about such longings, but he made allusions. Greeny wasn't wild about the Eisenhower-era foods with which Walter indulged his customers. Indulgence, she felt, was the province of dessert. But she had been pleased when she won the account. Over the past few years, she had come to think of Walter as an ally rather than a client. Except for the coconut cake, filled with Meyer lemon curd and glazed with brown sugar, most of the desserts she made for Walter were not her best or most original, but they were exemplars of their kind. Portly, solid citizen desserts, puddings of rice, bread, and noodles, sweets that the pilgrims and other humble immigrants who had scraped together their prototypes would have bartered in a Mayflower minute for Greeny's blood orange mousse, pear ice cream, or tiny white chocolate eclairs. Walter had also commissioned a deep dish apple pie, a strawberry marble cheesecake, and a layer cake he asked her to create exclusively for him. Everybody expects one of those, you know, death by chocolate things on a menu like mine. But what I want is massacre by chocolate, execution by chocolate, firing squad by chocolate, he told her. So that very night, after tucking George in bed, Greeny had returned to the kitchen where she made her living, in a basement 2 blocks from her home, and stayed up till morning to birth a 4-layer cake so dense and muscular that even Walter, who could have benched a Shetland pony, dared not lift it with a single hand. It was the sort of dessert that appalled Greeny on principle, but it also embodied a kind of uber prosperity, a transgressive joy, flaunting the potential heft of butter, that protean substance as wondrous and essential to a pastry chef as fire had been to early man. Walter christened the cake Apocalypse Now. Greeny held her tongue.